Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, of the making of books, there is no end. How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Well, hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, with me in the studio today is my producer, Mr. Dan Arnfield. And it's something a little different today. I'm going to say, good morning, Dan.
Good morning.
Because we're not taping in the afternoon. And there's some rescheduling here at the studio. But it's fine. We're allowed to be here. So, again, there's no comments today. So I don't know if the problem is me or if the problem is all of you out there listening. It is summer, and we still can write in. You can still send some comments in. Now, for today's program, I will continue discussing Candace Millard's book titled Hero of the Empire. Now, for those of you listening for the first time, Miss Millard is a best-selling author whose books frequently appear on the New York Times bestseller list. So again, she's a great writer, and she really has a lot to say. Now, on my last podcast, I finished discussing part one, Push for the Younger, chapter two, beginning on page 25, and that was titled The Graven Palm. Now, for today's program, we will remain in part one, titled Push for the Younger, but we'll move on to chapter three, and that chapter is titled The Scion. And, of course, that begins on page 28. Now, this chapter is going to give us great insight into Winston Churchill's mighty push to get into politics at his young age. And so that's why she titles this whole section Push for the Younger, because Churchill really was a pushy guy, and he wanted to push himself into politics. Now, remember from last time, previously we learned that Winston believed that he would be called upon to do great things in politics. But he also had to learn how to manage the uncertainty of entering the English political scene in Oldham. Now, for Churchill, if there is uncertainty in his life, I mean, that really would drive him crazy. And so he did not like uncertainty. And it really was driving him crazy on who would be on the ticket in Oldham and who would not be on the ticket. And of course, then, we know that he had the problem with going to a palmist and to trying to figure out his future. And I don't want to get back into all of that again. But again, he really was a pushful kind of guy. And again, just waiting would drive him really insane. Now, before we start chapter three, I kind of like to do this now, so we're going to read chapter three. Now, before we start chapter three, because it's been a while, I'd like to read the bottom of page 26. And I think it's really, really very interesting here. And so, again, we're going to skip over all those things about palmistry and all that. And even Churchill, I think I mentioned this before, he really was smart enough to not let her write in her book what she read in his poem. And anyway, I, to be honest, you know, in the back in the 70s when I was in college, I did have my poem read, and I thought it was weird, and I didn't think it mattered much. And so that's how I really feel about palmistry. It's fake. Anyway. But at the bottom of page 26, it says, Churchill's rise to prominence was to begin even sooner than he and perhaps Mrs. Robinson had predicted. And so it is interesting how things happened in Winston Churchill's life. It says, just a few weeks after, and this is page 27, just a few weeks after Churchill dropped his letter in the mail, and essentially now what that means is when he wrote back to Mrs. Robinson, in a letter and saying, no, you're not going to use my poem in your book. But anyway, he dropped his letter in the mail, And then he went to the town of Oldham. And what happened there is, in a stunning turn of events, lost one of its representatives to sudden death. It was not, however, the aged and feeble James Oswald, who had long appeared to be at death's door, but his robust and charismatic character, Robert Ashcroft. Mr. Ashcroft was essentially stricken with pneumonia on June 12th. Ashcroft quickly fell into a semi-conscious state. By the 18th, his doctors acknowledged that there was very little hope, and by the 19th, he was dead. And so essentially, if Winston Churchill had just waited it all out, he would have found out what was going to happen anyway. But it says there was less than a month before the election, and the Conservative Party now needed not one candidate but two. So the trial speech was forgotten, and Churchill was on the ticket. Whether he was ready or not, in his own mind, of course, he was more than ready. He was chomping at the bit. There is no doubt, he wrote to his mother, that if anyone could win the seat, I can. So that's how that's good information that we can rely on now as we get into this chapter 3. Now, chapter 3 is titled The Scion. And I want to give you the definition of a scion. And it can be for gardeners, but it also can affect notable families. So here's the definition. And it says noun. It says the one first definition is a young shoot or twig of a plant, especially one cut for grafting or rooting. And a similar way of saying that is cutting graft slip shoot off shoot twig. So if that doesn't make any sense to you, just get online and look it up for yourself. So there you go. Now, the second definition is a descendant of a notable family. He was the scion of a wealthy family. So you can see that this chapter is really going to be about, Winston Churchill's notable family. And I don't think they were necessarily overly wealthy, but I've been to Blenheim Palace, and it sure looks like they had a lot of wealth. So, but anyway... In some ways, I wrote about this chapter. That what I do is I usually make a lot of notes, so I don't have to carry notes around. But it says here in this chapter, the beginning, it says, a few days after Robert Ashcroft's death, Churchill arrived in Oldham for the first time in his life. Although the town held none of the glitter of London or the mystery of Bangalore, it was gritty and real, and in its own way powerful, founded in the Middle Ages. Oldham had transformed during the Industrial Revolution from a tiny, thin-soiled hamlet good for little more than grazing sheep to a powerhouse of the textile industry, widely recognized as the cotton-spinning capital of the world. If ever the Industrial Revolution placed a town firmly and squarely on the map of the world, a local historian would declare some 70 years later, that town is Oldham. And so in previous podcasts, I've talked about Mr. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. And when Churchill was alive in that area in England at that time, is that England was really coming on the scene to be a major empire. And so here we can see that the Churchill was right in the middle of all this, the growth and Britain becoming a great empire. And it goes on here to say, Churchill, however, was in Oldham only for one reason, and that was to win an election. So what she's saying there is that Winston Churchill didn't appear to be, wanting to get involved in the sheep industry, but he wanted to win an election. That's what he really wanted. He wanted to be into politics. That's why he left the army. His first speech there was to be given at a most impressive building in town, the Theatre Royal. Rebuilt after a fire had burned it to the ground 20 years earlier, the theatre, a four-story red brick building, was now perched somewhat awkwardly on Horse Hedge, a precariously steep cobblestone street in the middle of the town. In its massive front doors, however, flanked by two ornate pillars, its keystone inset with a carved bust of William Shakespeare opened onto a lavish Italianate all. And so the thing is, it's really interesting, as we know from history, that Shakespeare was very important even to Churchill. Churchill studied Shakespeare. And you can see, even though this may have been a little industrial town, or it may have been, a town was just interested in sheep, raising sheep, they still thought a lot about William Shakespeare. And, we know, Mr. Gerald Fleury has taught us here at the college that he believed that God raised up William Shakespeare to teach the British how to rule an empire. And so here you have this little town. It's a big town now in terms of the Industrial Revolution, but they were really into Shakespeare as well. And so I think that's really, really quite fascinating. And he describes, or she describes, the inside of the theater. It says, inside, the three horseshoe-shaped galleries faced the curtain stage, stacked on top of another and held up by 10 Corinthian columns. Although the lower galleries were ostentatiously decorated, the third was noticeably more modest, and the fourth, just visible beneath a large chandelier that hung from the arched ceiling, did not even have seats, only wooden steps on which the audience stood. And so, they did have, political leaders come into the theater and give presentations, and the audience would have to stand. They couldn't sit down. Every row from the first to the fourth was completely filled for the night's event. In fact, so great was the interest that even in this cavernous hall, there was not enough room to accommodate everyone, and hundreds of people had to be turned away. So this is where Churchill is going to have one of his it won't be his first speech, but it was really an important one at that time. And it sounds to me a lot like Donald Trump. You know, there were so many people came to the Bronx that, everybody was saying he bussed people in. He didn't bust people in. They just wanted to hear him. And so I'm talking about Donald Trump. Churchill's been dead a long time. So anyway, now just to go, this is, we're now on page, the Sion chapter is page 28. I've already slipped over to page 29. So Churchill's life on the public stage had begun just a few months earlier when he gave his first political speech before even becoming a politician. While visiting the Conservative Party headquarters in London, he had spotted a book with a white label that read in words that had filled him with the thrill of possibility. And this is really amazing. Remember now, he's in his early 20s. He really does, he really is kind of pushful. I mean, he really wants to get ahead. He really wants to be in politics, so he finds this little book. It says, Speakers Wanted. He said, scanning the pages with the eye of an urchin, looking through a pastry cook's window, he had alighted upon an opportunity in Bath, speaking to the Primrose League. Although he had given that speech on a platform made of four boards, precariously balanced over a row of barrels, he had immediately been hooked. For Churchill, few things in life could compare with the thrill of climbing onto a stage, stepping behind a podium, and commanding the attention of every man in the room. So, he was really pretty bold. I don't know if I get on a bunch of boards and stand on barrels, but he did. And she goes on to say, as much as he loved public speaking, it did not come naturally to him. Now, I think this is really important for all 20-year-olds. Sometimes we have desires to do things. We may not be as ready as we should be, but you can get there if you put in the work. And this is what he did. He really put in the work. She goes on to say, to begin with, he had a speech impediment that had plagued him since childhood. Unable to pronounce the letter S, he had practiced over and over the sibilant sentence, the Spanish ships I cannot see, for they are not in sight. So he had a problem with speaking. He had a speech impediment, but he did the task to overcome it. And so all of us have to do that. We want to do things, and sometimes we may not be ready. We have to overcome it. He says, she goes on to say, before leaving for India, he had turned for help to a family friend, Sir Felix Simon, who was a renowned throat specialist, Semin had assured him he did not have a physical deformation and should be able to overcome the problem with practice and perseverance. And so again, for all of you out there that are in your early 20s, and maybe you're into sports, maybe you're into all kinds of things. Even now that I just turned 72, I'm still taking Irish dance. And you know what? When I read this, I have to practice and persevere. And it's just something you have to do. And I really enjoy it. I really want to do it. And I'm learning. And so don't be surprised if you're in your 20s and 30s that you could think you're really ready for everything, but you maybe need to be, well, practicing and persevering. And so that's a good point. Page 30 now, it says, instead, Churchill slowly came not only to accept, but even value his distinctive way of speaking. And so he thought, well, maybe the S isn't so bad. You know, maybe that's kind of cool. He says, a number of men whom he admired, from the Prince of Wales to the Prince's close friend, Colonel John Palmer Brabazon. Now, hopefully all of you can remember Brabazon. I mean, he really is interesting, and we're going to get another little taste of it right now. He said, Brabazon could not pronounce the letter R, a defect that, because of the Prince of Wales, was considered fashionable in many circles. Churchill would admiringly recall Brabazon shouting, where is the London Twain? And when told that it had already left, demanded haughtily, gone, boing, another. And so here the Prince of Wales thought that was cool that you would speak that way. And so, you know, so Churchill, he practiced how to say the S, but he didn't let it bother him. And it made him cool. So this, again, everybody, we're on page 30. This is really a good page in the chapter. It says, although he would become famous for his sharp wit, Churchill was also uncomfortable addressing an audience unless he had carefully written and exhaustively rehearsed every line of his speech. Unlike his father, who was famous for his long, witheringly eloquent, extemporaneous speeches, Winston spent hours preparing for every formal lecture or even brief remarks, and would do so throughout his life. His close friend, Frederick Edwin Smith, 1st Earl of Birkenhead, would later joke that Winston has spent the best years of his life composing his impromptu speeches. And so again, this is really great education, and hopefully there are some younger people out there reading this book, and if you're a parent and you're reading the book, make sure you pass it on to your children and actually read it with them. And so Winston really had to work hard. It says, neither his speech impediment, however, nor the long nights spent writing and rehearsing had dimmed Churchill's delight in campaigning or his confidence that he would captivate any crowd. And then, this is really pretty arrogant, but he says, personally, I'm very popular here, he wrote unselfconsciously to his cousin Sonny early in the campaign. I'm always received with the greatest enthusiasm. So that was good for him. But, you know, I guess a little more humility would have probably been better as well. It says, she goes on to say, nor did it take Churchill long to realize that he had something more than just personal charm at the podium. Not only was he a uniquely talented orator, but even at just 23 years of age, it was clear to him that he had a potential to become a great one, perhaps one of the greatest. He said, I improve every time, he would write to a friend just before the election, strikingly aware of what the future might hold. At each meeting, I am conscious of growing powers. Now, this is going to come back to bite him. I'll just give you I'm looking at my time clock, too, because I don't want to miss some of these things. But, that's kind of cocky to say at each meeting I'm conscious of growing powers. So now we're going to move on to Oldham. It says, on the night of Churchill's first speech in Oldham, among the many faces in the crowd, in the crowded, darkened theater was one that he had only begun to recognize, and that was of his running mate, James Maudsley. Now, it's interesting. Maudsley, bearded, balding, and 51 years old, was as different from Winston Churchill as it was possible to be. So here's his running mate. He's 51. He's very bearded and balding. And, can you imagine Winston Churchill at 23 saying, "This is my running mate," you know, who's a sheep herder. So it goes on and says, the father of seven children, he had been born a cotton spinner's son and had worked in a cotton mill himself from the time he was 9 years old. Maudsley knew firsthand what it meant to be a member of the working class in Victorian England and had been politically active for decades, serving as a chairman at the Trade Union Congress, holding the position of General Secretary of the Amalgamated Association of Operative Cotton Spinners since 1878, when Churchill was 4 years old. So can you imagine what that would have done to his ego to realize his big running mate, who had more understanding in politics, by the way, you know, was 51 years old, and he had been spinning cotton since Churchill was 4 years old. So the press, the press drilled with this odd pairing, had christened Churchill and Maudsley as the scion and the socialist. And so everybody, you have to understand that Churchill is the scion. He's the notable guy. He's from a notable family. Everybody knew his dad, kind of thing. And so, but then Mr. Maudsley would be the socialist. And he said a nickname that embarrassed Churchill not at all. So he was called the scion, and that didn't bother him. Although of the two, Maudsley was the only one with any actual political experience. Churchill was not shy about what he believed to be his own contributions to their candidacy. Maudsley, he would later write, was proud to stand upon the platform with a scion of the ancient British aristocracy. So you can see that they must have worked it out where they actually got along together. And so, I think Churchill did come from a very prominent family. And, he was, I think, very approachable. And so people liked him. People came to like him. Now, later in his years, people did not like him so much because he really stood up for the rule of law. And that's really different. He says, all of the two, Maudsley was the only one with any political experience. Churchill was not shy about what he believed to be his own contributions to their candidacy. He says, not surprisingly, the newspapers often saw things differently. We shall see throughout the contest, predicted the Manchester Evening News. Mr. Churchill, who as a politician is hardly out of swaddling clothes, pushed to the fore in order that Mr. Maudsley may be able to carry him into Parliament. So that sounds like a newspaper. Yeah, he's in swaddling clothes and he has to be like a baby. He's got to be carried into Parliament. So that's the way it is in life. Sometimes things are really good. Sometimes things are not really, really good. You're going to have people that like you. You're going to have people that are picking on you. Says the audience at the theater Royal, however, which made up almost entirely of cotton spinners and textile workers, did not seem to mind. They had in their midst a young man whose life had been nothing like their own. When Churchill, who was first to speak, took the stage, it was to the sound of raucous cheers. As he began to speak, his carefully prepared notes before him, his hands either placed confidently on both hips or raised in the air to emphasize a point, he found that the audience was not just willing to listen, but was an enthusiastic and active participant in his speech. So he did have a lot of opportunity there, and he was really accepted. Throughout, he was listened to with the closest attention. A reporter from the Morning Post would write, the only interruptions being those of hearty, spontaneous applause or the interjections of the delighted auditors. That's plain speaking, shouted a stentorian voice. We understand that, and we like it. And so, Churchill wasn't a Shakespeare. he didn't write poetry. He didn't, put a lot of flowery words into his speech. But he talked to the local man. he was able to relate to the local people, the workers, the hard workers, the industrialists. He says, while Churchill's speech lasted nearly an hour and covered everything from working men's compensation to the future of imperialism. So think about this. He's 23 years old, and he's talking about imperialism. He's talking about the British Empire. And he says he was making the argument that England was without a navy would be like Oldham with all its chimneys broken, all of its furnaces cold, and all of its factories deserted. So here he is in Oldham. It's a great capital for the woolen industry, and he's talking about the empire. And said if England doesn't have a navy, then just imagine Oldham with all of its factories deserted and all the chimneys not burning wood. And so he took the image of their local area to give them an understanding of how important a navy would be to the empire. Now that to me is genius. That's a genius way to handle it. All right, let me see what else I get done. We're getting close to the end here. I'll just read this one paragraph. It says, the men and women of Oldham heartily agreed. By the end of the night, the town's aldermen would invite the audience to recognize in Mr. Winston Spencer Churchill a statesman of the future. An audience member, perhaps in Churchill's speech, what Mrs. Robinson saw in his palm went even further. We have, I do believe, if God should spare his life, he predicted, the future premier of England. And so there it is. He finally got his start, you know, even though Mr. Ashcroft had to die to do it. But he really, really got his start. And here the people there are just enthralled with him. So that's all the time I have for today's program. Now, on our next program, we are going to continue with the choice of Pushful the Younger, Chapter 4, and that is Blowing the Trumpet. So we're going to stay in Pushful the Younger, but we're going to move on to Chapter 4, and that chapter is titled Blowing the Trumpet. So this book does cover the details of the Boer War and Churchill's rise to great leadership. We're doing the political part first, but remember now, this is a wonderful supplement to Churchill's book, My Early Life, and continues the history of Winston's success in politics. Now, you can buy Candace Miller's book at Amazon.com. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.